Okay, we'll get started with the afternoon session here. For those of you who don't know me, I'm S.W. Wirth. Among other things, I'm the SNIA Board of Directors, and so help put together the Storage Developer Conference. So you get about a 30-second ad here. For those of you who are not aware, Storage Developer Conference is in September. You can find out more details by looking at storagedeveloper.org, and you should have already had an invitation sent to you probably. If you're thinking about going, the past presentations for Storage Developer Conference are already up on the website going back to, I think, 2008. In particular, there's very strong tracks there on SIFS SMB, SMB2, SMB 2.2. And of course, in co-location with Storage Developer Conference, we have the SNIA SIFS SMB, SMB 2, 3, X PlugFest. Last couple years, that's had over 100 engineers from 5 different continents, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 different platforms and products, and in the neighborhood of 25 companies and organizations. We say and organizations because there's this ragtag group from Samba team that seems to work for a lot of different companies, and so we kind of build them as Samba team, but sometimes they come in as their own company. Employer affiliation. So we encourage you to come to that, and it'll be about the same as it was last year. We start out on Sunday morning with the PlugFest. Conference starts on Monday morning. We will, for those of you who submitted sessions, the program committee, me and the SNIA Tech Council, are about a week late on that, on sending out the acceptances, but that should be out there real soon now, and then the agenda will be up on the website shortly after that. Again, we'll have the plug fests, and there will be, you know, some free full conference passes associated with that. So, ready? Okay. So if you have any questions, look for me walking around, and we can talk about Storage Developer, but I know I've seen a lot of you there before, and it's about the same thing this year. It'll be a good event. And, of course, it's not just Microsoft file protocols. There's quite a bit of discussion from everybody, not just file protocols, but also solid-state storage, cloud storage, latest developments in hardware, and block storage protocols. So quite a good event. Look for it. Okay, so this afternoon's session, Brian Matthew. Again, as most of you know, that storage in Microsoft is kind of, you know, scattered around in various groups, and over the next, actually today and the next couple of days, the people you've been hearing from previously, a lot of them have been from the file services team, so Tom Talpe and David Krusey and me. And there's also later on the program people from SQL Server, which is a separate, its own chunk of business. Also from Hyper-V, all those are in the server and tools and server and cloud org. And then over in the Windows client org, the Windows core org, there's something called storage and file systems, and they do the interface with the hardware and then the file system sitting on top of that. And file systems is now plural, as Brian's going to talk to us about. So a lot of this talk is going to cover Windows 8 behavior. These guys are more focused on the client side, but then, of course, on the file server, the file access protocols, SIFS, SMB, et cetera, and all of the SMB Direct and stuff that you've seen, we build on top of that. So Brian's going to cover a lot of the Windows behavior, and I'll let him walk through what he's going to cover.
All right, thanks, SW. So this talk, I just came back from Orlando. I was at North America Tech Ed. We actually made some changes to some slides there, so I'll be switching back and forth between two decks because I haven't put everything into this deck yet. But of course, I'll make this deck with integrated deck available at the after the end of this talk. So let's first talk about, well, these two capabilities. So in Windows 8, our storage team delivered a number of capabilities. I actually talked about all these in TechEd, but we're only going to be focusing on some of them in this talk today. We'll be focusing on our new file system, resilient file system, our new storage platform, storage spaces, and our integration with advanced storage arrays. So Windows supports two types of basic mechanisms for data access, be it block with application servers directly connected to your storage, or be it file access through a file server. And well, you guys know file servers, right? And we support traditional storage deployments connected to a traditional storage array. Or in Windows 8, we are enabling a new type of storage platform low cost, and this is called storage spaces. So we have delivered capabilities for both sides. We have capabilities for traditional storage arrays, and I'm sure you've heard of it, offloaded data transfers and thin provisioning. And we have a new storage platform, storage spaces. We'll just briefly talk about storage spaces in this talk. It's really local, and it's more of a, you know, this is what we're doing, Windows 8 sort of thing. And you guys might just want to know about it. So let's just jump right into storage spaces. So with this new storage platform, we have introduced a couple of abstractions, the first of which is called a storage pool, which is a means of aggregating a collection of physical disks to provide isolation and to simplify management. So I have a collection of just physical disks exposed by perhaps a box of disks, a JBOD, such as the ones below, and I can pool that into a storage pool. And this isolates and aggregates those physical disks. So this is the unit of management for your storage, the storage pool.
And what connectivity would you have from that?
So these are shared SAS JBODs, just simple SAS.
SAS.
Yeah, absolutely. Bare basics here. And so I have this pool of disks. And from this pool, I can carve out some amount of capacity or some amount of resiliency. And this would be a storage space. So for instance, if I have a pool of, I don't know, 1 terabyte disks, 20 of them, I can carve out a 10 terabyte storage space that's mirrored. So it provides resiliency against a single disk failure. Or storage spaces can also provide resiliency against two disk failures. But as Windows needs to scale from the needs of my small laptop here to a large data center, we support a variety of interconnects, SAS, USB, and SATA. And of course, we support shared SAS JBODs, which is necessary for if you want, you know, a lot of scale with storage spaces. And there's a variety of JBODs available on the market today from many of our partners. By utilizing flexible commodity storage of differing configurations, we enable a very simple deployment model. So where you can create virtual disks, or in other words, spaces, and with different capabilities depending on your workload needs. So these virtual disks are integrated in Windows. Even though they're just virtual objects, they appear as Windows as just disks. So again, this is local only, but they're just disks to Windows. So all applications seeing that storage just sees a disk. So it's no different than anything else today. So all of your workload can just run on top of it. And you can deploy these disks as physical or virtualized servers, or again, being accessed over a file server. And storage spaces has most of the capabilities that you would expect from a business-critical storage solution. Resiliency to media failure through mirrored and parity spaces, supporting two-way and three-way mirror. We support hot spares in the pool. We also support thinly provisioned spaces, such that you can simply, you know, I can allocate some space ahead of, I don't have to allocate space ahead of time for my storage needs, and I can just add capacity in as I need it in the future. But uniquely, and this is really our segue into REFS that I'll talk about in a moment, we provide a unique ability in storage spaces to be able to look at, to be able to inspect, to be able to provide an API to be able to expose the multiple data copy that spaces provide. So as I said, spaces provides can provide up to three data copies. With these sets of APIs, you can actually query, applications can query each copy of the data, inspect that copy of the data to see if it's, you know, corrupted or not, and be able to tell spaces which copy is correct so that spaces can autocorrect, and so that the application utilizing that information will be able to utilize the right data. And I'll talk about that more when I talk about REFS. We integrate with failover clustering and CSV to provide a high availability and scale. And we are easily managed through PowerShell or the server manager. We also provide the ability to be able to provision your spaces depending on your workload needs. So for instance, if you have a VDI deployment or something like that, you can utilize SSD media for your high IOP space, for your high IOP golden images, and you can utilize, say, 10K or 15K RPM disks for your differencing disks or your user data. So we're very flexible in that. Quickly running through some deployments here. This is a standalone, so you have some single server with direct attached JBODs. You have some spaces and you have some workload. You know, and of course, you have to accept a certain amount of downtime if there was the single server to fail, but this is just a single non-cluster deployment. And most customers deploy this today. But spaces also supports cluster deployments if you want to scale. And here you have multiple servers connected to a shared SAS storage. So these JBODs have multiple ports at the back, so each server can see the same storage. If one of the servers were to fail, then simply one of the other servers would take over, would be able to take over that path. And this unit here is called a deployment element. So you can easily expand by adding more deployment elements. And most cluster workload, you can just move off the node that it's running on using, for instance, with virtual machines, you can use live migrate. And many other workloads are just a move operation. So it's very, very simple. And in a cluster, everything is stored in that CSV namespace. So even though you have multiple servers and multiple storage, you just have one namespace to talk to. And that's what failover clustering can do. And Spaces supports deployments at even more scale. So you can take that single deployment element and expand it sideways, and your workload still runs in that CSV. And it's all highly available. So just really quickly running through all this, because I know this is local only. Yes, sir?
So things like mirroring and data copies and such, who is doing it? Like, I mean, is there a filter that is copying files back or copying blocks?
So Storage Spaces is a new storage platform. It replaces, or it's a, not necessarily replaces, it's an option of utilizing instead of utilizing a traditional storage array. Windows does all the resiliency for you. You take a bunch of disks, just disks, from a JVOD, and Windows creates your storage pool, and Windows manages your storage pool, and you can create your storage space from that. And Windows handles all of the resiliency. All the resiliency, all the provisioning, and, well, Windows does all the performance work. Yes, sir?
Okay, so in the Linux world, we've had the MD device for ages, where we can, you know, we do everything in software.
Sure.
I'm trying to understand, the one thing I've heard that is possibly new, I don't know if it's unique, but it's possibly, you know, it's certainly new for Windows, is that ability to do the inspection and try to figure out which piece is bad.
Yes.
If you have multiple, otherwise, we're just talking about moving the management of the array to the Windows, server that's actually accessing the array. Isn't that it?
With Storage Spaces, you're not dealing with an array, you're just dealing with a JBOD. You're just dealing with physical disks.
Right, but that's what I'm talking about. You're creating an array out of your JBOD, but you're creating
correct.
It on the Windows side.
Yes, absolutely. You're creating on the Windows side.
So it's really the same as an MD driver would be?
Well, it provides Windows customers capabilities to use something other than what they would traditionally might deploy.
Okay.
Yes. But yes, you are correct.
Okay.
But you are correct that we do provide the unique ability for applications that have an inherent knowledge of the integrity of their data. So for instance, an enlightened database app puts checksums on their own
sure.
blocks.
Yeah, lots of apps do that already.
Absolutely, lots of apps do that. Storage Spaces provides those apps the ability to look at all the copies, find out which one's right, and use the right copy. And tell Spaces which copy is the right copy.
That's only if they don't match on the disk.
Correct. Absolutely.
So why would they not match on the disk? Are you creating some sort of snapshot? Or are you using some sort of other resiliency mechanism? Or what are you doing?
So if the copies don't match between the disks, that means something happened between the time you wrote that data and the time you read that data.
Right.
Bit rot. Something could have flipped
sure.
on the disk.
Right.
Who knows what happens, really? Or, I mean, you could have wrote to the disk, and the disk could have written something else.
Right.
And that really happens today. I mean, with the sheer amount of data that we're writing, I mean, the sheer amount of data that we're deploying, it happens.
Uh-huh.
And we have to deal with that.
Okay.
And just jumping right into REFS, because that's what everyone seems to be interested in. So this is the meat of our talk. Our customers asked us for a file system that focused on scalability, availability, and data integrity. And we have delivered this with the Resilient File System, which REFS for short. So a little background. Like I just said, storage continues to grow at an unbounded pace. We deploy so much storage today that corruptions are no longer the exception, but are commonplace. And we need to acknowledge this and deal with it accordingly. So we built REFS from the ground up to guarantee the integrity of your data through resiliency to corruption, regardless of software or hardware failures. But more than that, REFS is really a different file system. It's scale at a different design point than NTFS, supporting billions of objects, efficiently supporting billions of objects. It's availability at a different design point, again, than NTFS. There's no more check disk with REFS. And it's integrity, protecting and auto-correcting your data. So I just briefly walked through some of the capabilities here. With REFS, we check some metadata when it is written to be able to detect changes to to the on-disk representation when it is read again. So if something happened between the time you wrote it to the time you read it again, we're able to detect that. And again, as I was saying to this gentleman over here, when you deploy REFS in conjunction with storage spaces, which again is a local concept to a Windows box, we go a step further by utilizing those multiple data copies that storage spaces provides, such that REFS can look at each individual data copy, inspect which data copy is the correct one, auto-correct it if it's not the correct one, and return that copy back up to the application. And metadata is always protected, but we optionally protect user data.
So are you saying that REFS, see, because the upper line was always true for NTFS. The lower line, are you saying that without storage spaces, that is not true?
You mean the autocorrect portion? Or
The user data corruption is also detected.
So corruption in this regard is the ability to check if the data really was the same as when you wrote it. Corruption, let me explain this in a couple other slides, and it'll be more clear. Yeah. So REFS also focuses on scalability. And we can support petabyte plus data sets comprising of billions of files. And I'll talk about more of this in a moment. So REFS handles file system inconsistencies in an online manner. If it detects a problem with the metadata, it will fix that in an online manner. There's no more check disk. Well, we've also designed REFS to be able to evolve. And while it delivers a powerful set of capabilities now, you know, things change in the future. And we designed it to be able to efficiently evolve for new data sets, new devices, and new access patterns. Talking a little bit about integrity, we utilize allocate on write. And this helps eliminate a class of corruptions that arise from utilizing in-place updates. So if I were to, for instance, update some metadata in place, some disks, well, I mean, with the sheer amount of data that we're deploying, it just so happens that the data can not be consistent with what you actually just wrote. And this is just a fact of that we're deploying so much data. We're hitting that error percentage that you get with modern storage devices. And we utilize checksums, as I mentioned before, to be able to detect changes to on-disk representation since the data was written. And of course, we can configure, if you want to be able to utilize this integrity checking for your user data on a per volume, per file, or per folder basis. So this is just looking at the different. Yes, sir.
Can you just go back a slide?
Yeah.
Can you explain a little more by what you mean by allocate on write? Are you talking about metadata there, or?
So we're talking about how REFS would allocate space for either metadata or user data when we do a write. So let me back up a little bit. When you update a file, traditionally you just look at the place that that data existed and update that in place.
Yeah.
But the problem that can cause more corruptions. Right. So what REFS does is we use our allocators to be able to find a new block on a disk, a potentially unused block, or at least unused from our perspective, and use that new block instead of going back to that old block and updating that.
Okay. So how does that play into, because this is something that's
copy
interesting.
You're doing copy on write.
Oh, okay.
Copy on write.
Right.
Your copy, so when you write to a block, you're going to make a new copy and leave the old in place.
Absolutely.
So how does that play into pre-allocation strategies when you create a file or you set an allocation size to guarantee that there's always going to be that amount of data on the disk?
Actually, Matt might be able to help with that question.
So the NTFS API, or the APIs that you use for do things like pre-allocation, that is unchanged. It's just the underlying mechanism that has changed.
So theoretically, well, I mean, you could eventually get to the point where you'd run out of space to do copy and write.
Oh, sure.
Yes. But you could run out of space on any file system.
Well, no, because once you've done pre-allocation, then you've guaranteed that you've got that amount of space.
It's a quality of service guarantee.
Yes.
Right. So
and there are applications that basically will do pre-allocation because they want to make sure that they will never run into a write fail.
Right. And you, so essentially the state machine essentially looks like over time you will start reusing. It's not
it's not
a write once, never reused.
So you
do reuse
it's not like
previously
block
allocated
yet.
But deallocated blocks.
Okay.
So there's a sense of what's
the sense of what's fresh and what's
exactly. So in that sense it's like any other system.
Right.
In that case then, because you're allocating new blocks when you're writing copy and write, is this better tuned for an SSD type environment than it would be for a traditional disk?
So, are you going to talk about the allocators?
I just briefly talk about it.
Yeah. So, essentially, RFS has certain design attributes that take SSDs into account. NTFS, for example, when you create a file, you'll be writing to 5 or 6 or 7 different pieces of metadata on the disk. But RFS.
Hey Matt, can you use the mic and can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sorry.
don't stall below Brian either. He's doing a good job.
No, I'm trying to get out of Brian's way.
So, sorry for that. My name is Matt Garson. I work on the storage and file system team with Brian. The question was about whether REFS is tuned in any way for SSDs. The short answer is that REFS's design takes into account devices like SSDs, and so there are certain efficiencies when it comes to the way in which we write data, where relative to NTFS, we do so with fewer IOs, and there are certain other aspects around being able to write data in a more granular fashion, which takes into account SSD behaviors like wear leveling and things like that.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you very much. To protect against latent corruptions, or in other words, corruptions that occur in the media between access, like I mentioned before, we have an integrated scrubber that actually works for both REFS and NTFS, but there are key behavioral differences. And perhaps this slide will help you better understand both systems. So with NTFS, what the scrubber does is it verifies all copies can be read. Now this is corruption from the NTFS point of view. If I can't read my copy of the data, at least a copy of the data provided by stored space, one of the copies of the data, or perhaps just a copy of the data provided by a regular volume here, then this is considered a media failure. And this is a class of corruption. So when NTFS sees a media failure, or when the scrubber on NTFS volume sees a media failure, we'll get an alternate copy of the data. So if this guy can't be read, we'll use one of these two copies. And that's what corruption is from the NTFS point of view. And you know, this is great. This works absolutely great. But there's certain other classes of corruption, such as latent corruptions, that we experience today with the sheer amount of data we're deploying. With REFS, scrubber verifies, it goes a step further. By verifying the checksums on the data, we not only check if the data can be read, but we also make sure the data is actually the data you wrote by utilizing those checksums. So we inspect the checksum on all the copies of the data, and if an inconsistency is detected, we'll trigger autocorrect and return a healthy copy of the data. So we protect not only, we try to protect not only against propagating corruption here, but also against propagating corruption in the actual data set itself. Oh, and scrubber works in the background on your volume, and it'll just continually go through and check all of your data to ensure that there's no inconsistencies.
So there was something about tone writes being avoided in VFS.
Okay.
Where is that in all this?
So when a tone write happens, you can just get inconsistent data. And that's checked with the, you protect against that with the checksumming ability. I mean, with a torn write, you're not necessarily going to get a bad data block. You're going to just get inconsistent data. Does that make sense?
From what I read somewhere, VFS was an attempt to mimic what ZFS did. And one of the things that ZFS did was to do this copy on write so that there was no clone write. And
okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, maybe he can answer that.
So when you do a write, you don't want to be able to, you don't want to destroy the previous copy of the data. And that's what allocate on write does. So you allocate it somewhere else So you don't, if you're, for instance, what it was inconsistent, or what if the system went down during that write, or something happened to the storage, you don't destroy the old block. That's just what allocate on write system does. But if the data, if the write was incomplete, or if something happened to that storage, we're able to detect that data wasn't actually completely written, or was written wrong. And we can check that afterwards. Or if something just happened to the disk, I don't know, something just happened. A neutrino hit it, I don't know. Something happened to my disk. Something happened to that block, and it's just not the same as before. RFS goes a step further by making sure the data is the same. NTFS just makes sure the data can be read. Just make sure there's no bad blocks.
So the answer is yes, that RFS prevents torn writes. Brian's describing it in detail, but yes. The answer is RFS prevents torn writes and another set of sector-related errors.
Yes.
Lost misdirected writes as well.
So if you just go back and fix up the tree that points to which block, you wouldn't point the old blocks and return error or whatever in that case. Is that correct?
So the question...
Was asking about what happens when an error of the type we're discussing occurs. The thing to keep in mind is that when we're talking about allocate and write and checksums, we are talking about what we call integrity. So file system metadata in ReFS is always protected with these two mechanisms, allocate and write and checksums. User data is optionally protected, because as Windows, we have to support a breadth of applications, some of which do not need the file system to provide integrity. So the answer is yes, when integrity is used, always on file system metadata and optionally for user data, then in the event of that class of error occurring, the correction will be done automatically, transparently, in line, utilizing an alternate copy provided by storage spaces. In the absence of storage spaces, but in the presence of integrity, we will still detect it and log it. We just cannot correct it without the alternate copy provided by storage spaces.
Okay. But why not go back and just use with a previous copy? You're doing copy and write.
Yeah.
So you have the old block there. You could just revert to the... It's almost like rolling back a journal. I mean.
You could put it back in the free list. It's a problem. They don't have it there anymore. It's back in the free list.
No, you don't put it on the free list until you're done with your write. I mean, assuming that this write is atomic, right?
It is. You guys are both correct.
Okay.
You're right that the block will eventually go back into the free list, and you're right that the updates are. Sorry. Okay.
So the question is around why we must use an alternate copy rather than using the previous instance of that data. And there were two comments made, one around how the previous instance of that data eventually moves on to some sort of freed list, and another comment about how the writes must be atomic. Both are correct. Yes, writes are atomic, and yes, eventually freed blocks do end up on the free list. So if something were to occur during an atomic update, that update would, of course, fail, and the previous instance of the data would be valuable, or it would be... would be used. There's no need to get an alternate copy in that case. But what happens if the atomic transaction succeeds and then 30 seconds later, that previous data may have ended up on the free list. So at a high level, the point is that to do corrections in the event of detected corruption, we do require an alternate copy to cover both the linear, anything could happen at any point in time. Outside of that very narrow transactional window, you need to use an alternate copy.
So for scalability, RFS uses B plus trees for all metadata. And we actually do embedded B trees so that you have a B tree for your root and embedded B trees for all your subdirectories, so that at each layer, you can really have the same amount of scale or a similar amount of scale. And by utilizing these types of data structures, we scale beyond what was previously possible with NTFS, or at least what was previously possible to be achieved efficiently with NTFS. And as Matt mentioned before, simple file system operations, such as a create, with RFS, it's a lot more efficient. We only touch two or three files. With NTFS, it was potentially could take a longer time by utilizing six or seven operations at a time to do, for instance, a simple create. We also have a hierarchy of allocators. So we have allocators for different size data. We have small, medium, and large. And this happens in an automatic manner. So if we detect that your data is coming in at a large granularity, we'll be able to utilize a larger allocator so that we ensure that you at least have some sense of locality for your data. AppCompat. I'm sure you guys are all interested about this. So when designing REFS, we've tried to build on NTFS's 20-plus years of AppCompat. And while REFS uses most of the upper layer, so we have our upper API layer for access, you know, FS controls, create file, Win32, all that stuff, we pretty much took out the on-media store for NTFS, replaced it with MinStore, which provides all the new capabilities that we mentioned before. So most of our upper layer APIs between the two file systems are similar. All the bottom level stuff is completely new in REFS. And again, by doing this, we support the majority of existing Win32 APIs, but there are certain features that REFS does not support. And some of them are intentional, for instance, short names, and some of them are a matter of, or in this initial release, scheduling, to be honest. We focused on providing availability, scale, and data integrity, and frankly, some things had to be cut. So here are a small list of the features. Yes, sir?
Can you handle sparse files better now?
What do you mean by better?
NTFS was pretty poor at it. It always seemed like if you issued a, I come from doing IO to it, to the server, to like a SIP server, do a write far long past end of file. NTFS seemed to go in zero till the file. Get to the point where you were doing, so if you had a zero link file and then you write the two gig mark, it would take minutes sometimes to come back because it would have to sit there and write to the disk and zero fill the file. Does REFS handle sparse files better? And then can you go and do it, write it?
Does it actually do
does it actually do sparse files now?
Yeah, so, yes.
So REFS supports sparse.
That would be helpful.
The question was about REFS's semantic behavior with regard to sparse files, and a shorter question of whether REFS supports sparse files. Yes, REFS supports sparse files for non-integrity user data streams. Whether REFS supports REFS's support of sparse files for non-integrity user data streams is identical to NTFS's. So what?
Okay. Fair enough.
Please tell me you're not putting name streams back in. I want to hear that from you guys. Name streams are dead, dead, dead.
There's a question around support for name streams in REFS, and in Windows 8, REFS does not support name streams.
Are there any plans to support name streams? This is what scares me. Because they're awful. I have pictures of the Windows Process Manager showing my file.txt being run as a process because it's people are hiding viruses in it, and they're just an utter pain to emulate. So I'm really hoping that they will never come back. I'm very happy they're dead. I just, like a vampire, I want to stick a stake through that thing's heart and make sure it never comes back.
We certainly appreciate that feedback.
I will shed no tears if they never come back.
So I just want to walk through a quick deployment, what we think will be typical with REFS, at least on a Windows system. So again, our goal is to be deployable on cost-efficient hardware. So here, in this deployment, you have guarantee of data integrity with REFS through integrity streams and checksums. We have resiliency against media failure through storage spaces. And we have high availability provided by Windows clustering. And in the presence of any one of these failures, be it failure of disks, failures of servers, some bit flips in your file system, user data access is not interrupted. And as with any new platform, we expect customers to be pragmatic about deployments. And there are some implementation limitations with REFS in this release. But again, we have focused on many of the key attributes that many of our customers want. And for the vast majority of our customers that need those capabilities, namely scale, availability, data integrity. RFS is what we expect them to evaluate RFS if RFS is what they really want. Again, some features are not implemented in RFS, such as short names, and some features, and some as a matter of scheduling. But most of the Win32 APIs should be present, so most of your applications should just work. But of course, there's no guarantee. So we expect customers to evaluate RFS first before deploying it. Okay. So when you use RFS with storage space, it's really a better together sort of thing. But of course, RFS can be deployed on any type of storage. It can be deployed on a storage array, or can be deployed on some other type of storage. It can be deployed on storage spaces. And with this new storage platform, RFS delivers scale, data integrity, and availability that many of our customers really need from a file system that can be used from now and into the future. Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Just as a minor postscript to what Brian said, there's a 40-page or so document available today on Microsoft.com that describes all of the changed FSCTLs and APIs in RFS. So if you're investigating RFS from an app compat perspective, the document's available on Microsoft.com today. It's accurate as of beta. So you can use that as a reference to get an overview of all the new APIs and other changes that might be interesting.
Find it?
RFS.
I'll integrate all the links into the presentation, which I'll share.
Thank you.
No, I will integrate in the presentation. So these are actually slides from my tech ed presentation, and I just want to walk through some of our investments to storage arrays. Thank you, Matt. Hold on 1 second. Laptop's acting up. Okay, here it is. So Server 2012 works in conjunction with many of the advanced capabilities in storage arrays. Oh, yes, sir.
I was wondering, are you going to have questions at the end? Because I wanted to see if we could ask some RFS questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'll try to save a few minutes for questions. And I'll be in the hall if anyone wants to ask any questions. So the first of which advanced capability is called thin provisioning, which many, many customers use. However, there's always existed an inherent disconnect between a view of storage from the file system and a view of storage from the storage array. So with Server 2012, we're unifying this view. So when a file delete comes down through the file system, it would basically be translated into whether or not that file delete came from a local system, from within a VM, or from a file server, to the file system itself. We translate that file deletion into a trim or unmap command, and that would eventually go down to the storage array. So be able to free the blocks that back that file. And I'm going to actually show you a diagram of how this works in just a second. And we utilize standardized notifications when your pool capacity is reaching full capacity so that we enable fast responsiveness for your IT pros to be able to add in more disks as necessary. We use industry standards. We worked very closely with the standards body to be able to identify thinly provisioned LUNs in a standard manner. And optimization, notification, and identification just work automatically with a variety of storage arrays or with storage spaces. So this is how optimization works. You have a file deletion from a virtual machine or from a file share or even from a local volume. This goes down through the stack, goes through the filters, goes down to the file system. The file system recognizes which blocks back that actual file delete. So for instance, if it was a VHD, it would map, hey, these are the sets of blocks. It was a file, these are the file ranges. Or in a file server, same thing. It would be translated to a trim and unmap request, which basically contain the actual blocks on the physical storage device. And that would go down to your storage device, be it spaces or be it a volume exposed by a storage array. And eventually, it'd go down to the pool. So the storage array or storage spaces can free up the capacity that back those blocks which NTFS asked it to unmap. And this really helps be able to have customers utilize your storage pool for other business needs. So if I have a thinly provisioned 10 terabyte storage volume and I want to deallocate some space, a large amount of space, for instance, if I have a few VHD files I no longer need, I'll be able to use that space for something else. The second of which capability is called offloaded data transfers. So again, we have worked very closely with storage vendors, many of you I see in the room, and standards bodies to help to develop an industry-leading capability to efficiently move data securely across machine boundaries and potentially even geo boundaries. And this ability to move data across machine boundaries has never existed in the past. And we've plumbed this capability throughout the stack, so you don't need to make a conceited effort to take advantage of it. So this is how data has moved around today. Reads and writes. We have two applications running on, I have an application running on these file servers, or these machines, and I want to move data that exists between this virtual disk and this virtual disk. And this is all controlled by the application. Today, your app would read the data from the virtual disk. The data would be returned back into a buffer in this machine. This buffer would be transmitted across some network transport. This application would write the data back to the virtual disk, and of course, you get the results back. So you have reads, you have a data transfer, and you have a write. The thing is, there seems to be some amount of inefficiency here. I mean, you're moving data out of this virtual disk into and across this network transport and back to this virtual disk. And when these virtual disks reside in the same storage, I mean, it's not very efficient. So why can't we offload this process to the storage itself? And that's exactly what we do. So we try to preserve the same philosophy of reads and writes that are familiar with apps today. But we abstract the data that's intended to be transferred with a lightweight token. And this represents a point-in-time view of the data. You can sort of think of this token as a super compressed, unchanging view of the data. And when transferring data across machine boundaries, as you see here, between applications, a similar read style operation happens, but instead of filling a buffer with the data, you're filling it with the token. And the token's a very small entity. So you're transferring this very lightweight token across network transport instead of your big buffer full of data, and you're writing this token down to this virtual disk. And upon receipt of the token, the storage array recognizes it and independently performs the data movement very quickly. And in this example, previously you transmitted data across. If this was a 1 gig pipe, your data transfer would be limited by that pipe. So instead here, the data transfer occurs at the actual speed which your storage array is able to perform the data transfer at.
Does the transfer take any checksum to maintain integrity?
I would imagine the token is a checksum.
The token is really...
But this, I mean, this is the same kind of thing NDMP used to do.
Sorry, I'm not familiar with NDMP.
It's okay, but that, I mean, yeah, back-end transfers have existed a long time.
Sure, back-end transfers absolutely have existed. And if there was a management app that would be able to control this, it would work. But in this case, we're just doing a simple drag and drop. We've integrated, the key thing here is machine boundaries. This machine has its own boundary and doesn't trust this machine and vice versa. If both machines trusted each other, again, it would not be a problem. But we exist in a world where we have secured boundaries at this end and secured boundaries at this end. You cannot just control, for instance, this guy just can't control this virtual disk, and this guy just can't control this virtual disk, because there's a clear separation here. And that's the key thing about offloaded data transfers, is the machine boundaries. The token is flexible enough to be even used across geo boundaries, because it's just a ticket for your data. It's just a ticket. I have this ticket, I can get into the amusement park, right? So before, data movement is at the machine level with the network transport, and after, data movement is offloaded into the array. And again, offloaded data transfers is plumbed throughout the stack and down to our core copy engine, which enables transparent utilization when a supported storage array is detected. So existing scripts, applications, copy utilities, even drag and drop, like I mentioned, should just work. And offloaded data transfers is great for scenarios we need to replicate data multiple times, such as with VM provisioning. I take a single golden image, spit it out 10 times, and there I go. And I don't impact the network, and I don't impact all the machines in that operation. Or similarly, with data mining or storage migration. So actually, in Orlando, I did a demo. So I had a traditional storage array, two file servers, and SMB share connected to those file servers. If I wanted to transfer data between this share to this share while the shares are mapped from my laptop, I would have to transfer the data all the way across the US and back again, which is inefficient. With offloaded data transfers, I guess I preserved the animation there. With offloaded data transfers, I just transmit the lightweight token. And a data transfer happens within the storage array itself. So it's very efficient, and it happens very quickly. And it does not, it's not limited by the slow WAN connection that I had at the conference center. So a subset of partners that have indicated support for thin provisioning and offloaded data transfers of Server 2012 is here. And we're working with many other vendors, and I see a couple in the room again. And I, of course, expect some of those vendors to announce support as they come. So either through optimized space utilization, threshold notifications, or efficient data movement, Server 2012 really takes advantage of capabilities present in many advanced storage arrays today. And all of this is documented in FSA and in FSCC. So you guys can just look at the documentation, see how the structures are formed, see how the behavior is. And actually, I wrote the offloaded one. So you'll just see how it works. So that concludes my presentation. And if you guys have any questions, I'll be here or I'll be outside afterwards. Any questions? Yes.
For the offload, are there new APIs for that?
So we have two new file system controls, FS control offload read, FS control offload write. Offload read gets the token for the desired file range, and you get the token back in a buffer. And offload write, you give it a token, you give it a destination, and you send it down to your LUN. Very simple. And we have them fully documented. FSA, FSCC, MSDN.
So the FSA document, which is the file system algorithm, some of you may be familiar with it from working with NTFS, Windows behaviors in particular, where it may be helpful, especially in an SMB server implementation. But that document has been published with the Windows 8 behavior updates, including FSA, including REFS. And it also has some other file system updates. It is included in the MSDN library for the open specifications. It's not in the preview node anymore. It's actually in the documents, included in the documents. So when you pull down FSA, it does have the updates that Brian just referred to. And I would point to Tom Talpe's previous presentation on the torque converter, which is recorded on channel 9 as well. That talks about this layer between the file system and the SMB area. Actually, it's included in both. It has to do with how errors are handled and returned back up. So that's another behavior area that's of interest. So hopefully those resources are also useful to you.
Yeah. So offloaded data transfers, two new APIs, and of course integration in the copy engine, FS control offload read, FS control offload write. For thin provisioning, we actually also have a new API, and that's FS control file level trim. So for instance, if I have a VHD file, just a VHD, and you know, has a start and has an end. But the VHD file actually is backed by an NTFS volume, even though this is an NTFS volume itself. So this could be backed by a range here, a range here, a range here. So we'll actually be able to, so when a file deletion comes to this VHD volume, it'll actually trigger a file level trim to be able to trim a portion of a file backed on that NTFS volume versus an entire file itself. So this is a new API, and we've actually documented this in I believe FSA and FSCC. So you can go take a look at that and see how it behaves. This is again a new API. Yes, sir.
So you wrote there that you have integrated this with RoboCopy.
Yes.
I mean you identified a couple, three applications. So what is it that they did? I mean, all they must have done is use this FSCTL, right?
So we did the changes to the core copy engine. In other words, copy file 2, copy file EX. And many applications already use those copy APIs. So as long as your application uses copy file 2, copy file EX, you'll be able to transparently utilize offloaded data transfers.
So it's not like you've actually changed RoboCopy.
Correct.
Okay.
And not like you actually have to change your scripts or most of your applications.
Okay.
As long as you use copy, it should just work.
Okay.
And we thought this was a key point in developing ODX. I mean, we can provide the APIs all we want, but the problem is people having to change their app to take advantage of it. So by just changing the underlying copy engine, drag and drop, robocopy, and most things should just work. And other applications, such as virtual machine management applications, can utilize a copy engine, or they can utilize the APIs, although we would recommend them use the copy engine. I mean, our copy engine has undergone years and years and years of tweaking, and designing a new copy engine is not exactly the easiest thing to do, as I'm sure many of you are aware. Are there any more questions?
Yeah, so four questions. On the last one you just brought up, does the file server use copy file?
Does the file server use copy file? Yes, it does.
Okay, so
it's just a file server. It's just a folder with a bunch. You can have a handle to it, and you can do any Win32 operation to that, any supported Win32 operation to that. So if a user already has a file handle, and that file handle is actually on SMB volume, that you can just use that in a copy file operation.
I guess what I'm getting at is that in SMB3 we have a we still have the copy chunk, so we can express a handle and arrange and copy that. And that'll transparently, if copy file is used at the target end, transparently take advantage of this.
Yes.
But it also looks like the T10 extensions are in there for the offload copy for SMB3 to use. And I'm wondering, sort of as an implementer, when the redirector would want to use, use these directly, rather than use the older way, which is going to fall into the copy file API naturally on the server side.
So you want to use this when you're copying between two different SMB shares, potentially residing on two different. You definitely want to use it when you have two SMB shares on two different file servers. Copy chunk won't work there. You're transferring cross machine boundaries. Even if you have two file shares on the same file server, but if you're backed by some intelligent storage array, you still might want to use it there because you don't impact the memory of the file server itself. It's really dependent on your implementation. You can choose.
But that should be transparent. So the file server should know this and call copy file, and the copy file API on a single system, on a single server system, the copy file API should know.
The copy file API will use offload before it uses copy chunk. However, as when you're implementing it yourself in your own products, you can choose to do it either way. Does that make sense? I mean, the behavior from an application point of view is that my data got copied across, nonetheless. If you want to take advantage of those capabilities underneath your system, then you can definitely do that if you want to. I mean,
I guess the interesting question will be whether the redirector uses the T10 style, uses the copy offload ever. If it uses copy chunk always because the server is smart enough, then that's good enough. But if the redirector ever has cases where it knows more, I mean, it almost sounds like there's no reason to ever use the block copy that you're doing here if the copy file API is smart enough, if the file server is smart enough. Because just let the file server do it and
right.
figure it out.
But the copy operation happens at the speed the file server can do it, and also your memory is impacted as well. The storage array underneath you could, for instance, pointer. You just create a new pointer when you copy the data over.
Right, but all that's transparent because the file server calls the API copy file. Copy file figures out the right thing to do internally. So unless copy file has cases where it can't get enough information to do it. And those are kind of what I'm poking at. Are there cases where the copy file API doesn't have enough information to make the right decision, and we need to make the decision in our app, in the redirector?
So if copy file encounters an error while attempting to perform offloaded data transfer, so for instance, if it sees that the source doesn't support ODX or the destination doesn't support ODX, then it won't do ODX and it'll fall back to what it traditionally does. Or if you have a case when I already have a token for some data, and I go to write it, but the write fails for some reason, either because I'm writing to perhaps an unsupported target, or, for instance, the storage array, or the token is expired, then we'll also fail back to the traditional copy operation. Remember, this offload of data transfers requires some supported storage underneath, source or destination, and by prioritizing using offload instead of using SMB the SMB copy chunk, you're able to perform the copy or usually able to perform the copy much faster than you can instead of utilizing the traditional methods. I mean, the copy is not happening in this file server; it's happening underneath. It should be able to happen much faster than what the file server can do. And that's why we've introduced this capability.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm hoping that the file server is calling the right API. So other questions. You mentioned reparse links weren't supported, or any reparse points. So are we only, you know, files and directories and no more reparse points ever?
We are looking at, based on customer feedback, we'll be looking which direction we're going to take in the future.
Okay, so not yet, though, just files and directories now.
Correct, files and directories, files, directories, and streams. Yeah.
But I thought we said no streams.
Streams, as in conventional streams without integrity and integrity streams. Not named streams, just regular streams. Yeah.
You mentioned a set of superseded features, you know, encryption, deduplication, offline files, compression. Are superseded. So, I mean, those are, you know, the bread and butter, right? Taking files offline, compression, encryption, dedup. So how are those handled if they're superseded?
So with REFS, one thing it doesn't implement is EFS, for instance. And this feature is superseded by BitLocker, which is fully supported in Windows Server, because REFS is only available in Server. And we feel that BitLocker is a great platform for encryption. And it can do full volume encryption, very flexible. And we feel that it'll be great for most of our customers.
So BitLocker per file encryption, policy-based encryption, can we still do all those things?
I'm not the BitLocker expert, so you'd have to talk to the BitLocker team. But I can get back to you. So if you give me your card, I can forward your questions to the right set of folks.
Okay, now on the other four, you mentioned the dedupe engine is gone, right? Is dedupe handled internally now on files?
So REFS in this release does not support data deduplication. Data deduplication is supported only with NTFS volumes.
What about taking files offline?
Taking files offline.
I mean, traditional thing you see storage management do is you have a dummy inode, and the file is written to some slower storage media, and you know, it's used for storage tiering by essentially everybody, it seems. So does REFS support, you know, basically leaving the inode in place, but the data's backed up?
Sorry, I don't believe we support that.
Okay, and no compression, right?
We do not support compression in this release, at least not file system compression. However, there could be filters on top of the file system that can perform their own compression.
Okay, so no EAs, no streams means no data tagging, no indexing, no way to do storage policy management based on tags?
Correct.
Okay.
In this release, we've really focused on several core things. Again, I mentioned it 100 times, but we've focused on scalability, focused on integrity, and focused on data availability. Many of our customers asked us a very long time for all these different features, especially data integrity, which is not available before. So if customers really need a system, for instance, deploying with a file server that needs data integrity, needs protection against latent integrity issues, then they should consider evaluating REFS. Now, of course, not every feature is implemented, and we understand that. And again, many of it was intentional, and some of it was scheduling. So we completely understand many features aren't there. And it's just a matter of we weren't able to have enough time to meet our goals in providing those three key tenets, and also meet all of the existing NTFS features that were developed over the past 20 years.
And part of what I was interested in is you know, since storage policy management tagging, index taking is a big thing,
yes,
is whether it just moved to the ACL or you moved it somewhere else now that EAs and streams aren't there. You know, if your goal is to just put it somewhere else in the file, because obviously you support ACLs, that's different. But if it's just not available, that's, you know, something to look for in the future.
So, please give me your card, and I will definitely look into those, and we appreciate your feedback. I think we're out of time, and I'm being warned by SW there. So if you have any more questions, I'll be outside or I'll be at the front. Yeah. Thank you so much.